tunnel before he gets away. Don't worry about me, I'll be all right.
Hey,
her rescuer said, laughing now.
You put your life on the line for me back there. Hanging with you until the ambulance comes is the least I can do, Nina.
She blinked, trying to remember. Had she saved his life?
Oh, right. The Night Hunter. Clown Mask had been shooting at him, and she'd steered the car into the trees.
The Night Hunter must have pulled her from the burning car, and he was here with her, now, waiting for the ambulance. She had finally met him. Only,
how,
she said, blinking with confusion, do you know my name? He didn't say anything for a beat.
Your wallet, he said. Sorry, I looked through it. I wanted to know to whom I owed my life.
How did you know? She asked. About me, that I was in the car with him.
I heard about the kidnapping over the police scanner, he said. I picked the two of you up as he merged onto 95. It was pretty easy. You were the only ones going 100 miles an hour. That was brave, what you did. Driving the car into the trees when he started shooting.
He said he was going to take me with him, Nina said. She didn't want to go into detail. Looking into those blue eyes, as cold as the air around her, she could see that she didn't have to. The mouth beneath the form-fitting rubber mask, the only part of him that wasn't swathed in black, set into a firm line. He knew. He knew exactly what she meant. The pain in her head was pulsating. The smoke from the burning car seemed to have seared her lungs, though she knew he'd pulled her away in time. Finally, Nina added, "Besides, he was shooting at you. You're not bulletproof." She thought of the song. "Are you?"
"Sort of," he said, and tapped his chest, which made a strange, echoing sound. "Kevlar body armor. So next time, don't ram into any trees on my account. No need. Though I do appreciate it."
His mouth twisted into a grin, convincing Nina that without the mask, he'd be handsome. Handsome, but also frightening. There was a considerable breadth of shoulder beneath the black body armor, not to mention the fact that his chest seemed about 1/2 mile wide. Still, for a moment, Nina saw something warm in those icy blue eyes. And then she heard the siren and saw the red and white flash.
"Looks like your ride's here," he said,
and she could feel him gently lowering her head.
"I've got to go. I'm not particularly well-liked by the local authorities. Besides, I have to go look for the driver of this illegally parked vehicle over here and have a few words with him."
"Wait," Nina said, her heart speeding up.
"You'll be all right, Nina," he assured her, squeezing her hand. "I've left flares, so they'll know how to find you."
"Not that," Nina said. She could feel the darkness closing in again, but she fought against it. "Who are you? I don't even know."
"Oh,"
he said with a smile, as voices sounded in the thick tangle of woods around them.
"I think we'll see each other again."
And then he was gone, just as the first emergency service worker stepped into the clearing into which he'd carried her and cried,
"Miss, it's all right, miss, we're here now."
For a few minutes, Nina wasn't sure he'd ever even been there. She thought she might have imagined the whole thing. Except that later, as they were loading her onto the ambulance, one of the EMS workers lifted the edges of the thick black blanket that had been wrapped so securely around her and asked,
"Where did this come from? It's not one of ours."
And then Nina saw, at the same time that everyone else on the scene did, that it wasn't a blanket at all.
"That's a cape," said one of the ambulance drivers.
"You don't think..."
one of the firemen began, but another cut him off.
"Don't start."
"We weren't the first on the scene," said another. "Someone pulled her out of the car, stopped her bleeding, and laid those flares."
Nina would have told them. She would have said who it was, and gladly. But she was too busy thinking about something else. One of the EMTs had asked her for her ID, and when she'd reached for her wallet, she realized she'd left it back at the mall, along with her purse, her cell phone, and everything else she'd brought with her to work that night. So the Night Hunter had lied about how he'd known her name. He'd known her name because he'd known her. He'd known her because... She knew him. They'd met before. Of course. Those eyes. Those icy blue eyes from all those photos in the newspaper. Those blue eyes that, far into their depths, had hidden wells of warmth. She'd know them anywhere. And he was right. They would be seeing each other soon. Tomorrow night, at Lauren Vanderwaals's party. And this time, Nina wouldn't feel weird about walking up and saying hi.
Tuition by Walter Sorrells. Read by Oliver Wyman.
Marlin's phone vibrated as the third tumbler clicked. He looked at his phone. It was Mom. Great. He thumbed the green button. What? He whispered, still twisting the knob on the safe with his other hand.
It's your mother. Couldn't you be a little more polite when you answer the phone?
I know who it is, he whispered. What do you want? We're kind of busy here. He glanced at his watch. 8:37. Time was running out. It was an antique Mosler Model 37B, the kind they used in banks back in the old days. In a perfect world, he would have drilled it. But drills made too much noise. The place where they were doing the job, the headquarters of International Logic Corp, was patrolled by well-trained security guards and protected by all kinds of motion sensors and sound sensors and heat detectors.
My book club's running late, his mom said. You think you can pick up your brother from chess team practice?
Marlin sighed. Mom, I'm busy.
Doing what? Doing what?
Okay, 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 he hissed. Among the other important things that she didn't remember about today, apparently she didn't even remember that he was on a job. I'll get Ray Ray. God. Marlin closed his phone, wiped his brow on his sleeve. Chess team. For God's sake. His fingers were cramped and tired from slowly twisting the dial on the safe. He was monitoring the sound of the mechanism through earphones. But he also had an electronic monitor with a little gauge on it that twitched at the tiniest sound. The Mosler was a beautifully made safe, old-school craftsmanship, with amazingly quiet tumblers. Only a real master could crack it by ear.
Who was that? Irving said.
Can we be quiet, Irving? Marlin said. I'm trying to concentrate.
Whatever.
Irving was a tall, old guy, like 40 or 50, who sat on the desk swinging his legs aimlessly. Marlin wasn't sure why his father had sent Irving along on this job. Marlin could have done this one by himself. Marlin waggled his fingers, trying to get the kinks out, then began working on the safe again, slowly twisting the dial. He was close now. One more number, and they could get the stuff and get out of here. After a few minutes, Irving hissed,
"Hey, guards!"
Marlin clicked off his flashlight and froze, his heart going into overdrive. The guards were only supposed to come around once an hour. Had somebody tipped them off? The footsteps grew closer and closer. There were two of them, talking. That was a good sign. If they'd been tipped off, they'd have their guns out and would be moving silently. Still. The footsteps stopped. He could see two shadows in the band of light that came through the crack underneath the door. They were standing right in front of the office, not 15 feet from where he was crouched. His dad had assured him this was going to be a big score. If he pulled this one off, his dad swore that he wouldn't have to do any of this crap again. This one job would pay for college, the full ride. Marlin had been admitted to Princeton in the fall, but the financial aid didn't cover everything. Even after the loans and the grants, he was going to have to come up with 18 grand every single year. 18 grand. How could anybody afford the place? Outside the room, one of the guards said,
What's that? Did you leave that there?
No, the other guard said.
It wasn't here before. You sure?
Of course I'm sure.
Well, open the door, you idiot. Something's not right here.
I don't have the keys. I thought you had the keys. I thought you had the keys.
Do I have to do everything around here?
The two guards walked away, bad-mouthing each other. They didn't sound very worried. But still, he wasn't sure what they'd seen out there in the hallway. Maybe Irving left something out there. The guy was so sloppy. Marlin never could figure out why his father kept Irving on in his crew. Marlin's dad was the kind of guy who always made sure every detail was right. Every detail. Bing. The elevator bell sounded. Then the elevator doors closed, and the voices of the two security guards disappeared.
We gotta clear out, kid, Irving said. They're on to us.
Marlin felt sick. He was close. So close. No, I'm almost there.
Kid, your old man'll kill me if I let you get pinched.
No! Marlin kept working the dial, eyes glued to the gauge on the monitor.
What do you mean, no?
That's my tuition in there. That's my ticket out of this crap.
Crap? You know what your old man went through to teach you everything you know? Safes, explosives, locks, alarms. Your family has been in this business for 3 generations. Your old man is a master. You lucky little punk. He's already taught you more than I learned in...
Shh! Marlin kept turning the knob. He wanted to rush, but he knew you couldn't rush a thing like this. Irving was right about one thing. His father had taught him well. At age 16, Marlin knew more about safe-cracking than most people learned in a lifetime. All those hours his father had drilled him, tested him, taught him, the shortcuts, the techniques.
It all comes down to intuition, though, his father always said. Some got it, some don't. And son, you've got it.
It used to make his heart swell with pleasure when his father said stuff like that. But now it made him all queasy and sick. He just wanted to go to college like a normal teenager. All this sneaking around and breaking into places had seemed fun when he was a kid, with no worries about jail or anything. But today was his birthday. Strictly speaking, he turned 17 in, well, in less than an hour. Which meant that by the time he finished this job, he'd be old enough to get sent up to the big house. Grown-up jail, bro. That was no joke. Irving started pacing up and down, staring at the stopwatch. He knew exactly how long it would take for the guards to get back. Everything had been timed down to the last second. It was a 2-minute and 20-second walk from the security office down on floor B to the office they were in. Round trip, 4 minutes, 40 seconds. His phone rang. Mom again.
Jeez, he said.
It's your mother,
his mother said.
I know. What?
Ray Ray just called. He's standing outside the school right now. How could you?
Crap. He'd forgotten all about Ray Ray.
I'll be there soon, Mom. God!
You're so touchy today. Why are you so touchy?
He hung up. Why was he so touchy?
Because you forgot my birthday, Mom. You and Dad and Ray Ray, you all forgot my birthday.
17. The big one. Here he was cracking a Mosler 37B in the executive boardroom of International Logic Corp when any normal kid would be at the frickin' Olive Garden shoveling a big plate of pasta in their face and opening presents while all their normal friends sat around laughing and joking without a care in the world. It wasn't right. Chess team.
Man, that chafed his ass. Had Marlin ever gotten a chance to be on the chess team? Or play Little League? Or be in a school play? Hell no. All these years, his father had been pushing him and pushing and pushing him, training him night and day, making him memorize a million locks and safes and alarm system schematics, building special tools in the machine shop, practicing his lockpicking skills. It never ended. Oh, Marlin, you're so smart and talented and blah, 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 blah. All these expectations, all this pressure. It wasn't fair. It was like it never occurred to the old man that a kid might want to be something other than a freaking master criminal. Ray Ray, on the other hand, never got pushed at all. He came home, he did his homework, he went to chess club or whatever, and nobody gave a crap that he couldn't open a safe to save his life. What a spoiled little brat. It was enough to make Marlin puke. How long? Marlin whispered. The gauge on the scope hadn't budged. 2:45, Irving said tensely. Do the Teasdale, Marlin said. Huh? The Teasdale. Do the Teasdale. It might give me another 2 minutes.
Or it might make them suspicious.
Just do it. This is my freaking tuition in here.
Your what?
College. It's my college tuition.
Irving stared at him like he'd just fallen out of the sky.
College? What are you talking about, college?
I'm going to college. Princeton. What's so freaking bizarre about that?
You make me sad, kid. What's Princeton gonna do for you? Teach you to be some kind of stuck-up jerk in a gray suit is what?
He looked at the stopwatch.
2:05.
Make the call. God!
Irving pulled out his phone, hit the speed dial button.
Yes, hi, security, he said,
doing a perfect imitation of a woman's voice. A very sexy woman.
I'm a little embarrassed. This is Miss Teasdale in accounting. I worked late today, and gosh, I'm just terrified of the parking garage at this time of the evening. I swear the other day there was a man lurking down there. Lurking. Yes, lurking.
Irving nodded his head, getting into his little act.
Could you? Oh, I just hate to trouble you, but it would really... Yes. Yes. You're so sweet. I know. I know. You're so sweet. I'll meet you at the elevator on the first floor in 2 minutes. Bye.
Scary, Marlin said. You're way too good at that. At least I'm not going to Princeton. Jesus, H. Couldn't you at least go to Pitt, Ohio State, Michigan? Someplace with a football team?
Princeton has a football team.
Pfft,
Irving said, waving his hand dismissively.
48 seconds.
Marlin kept working the dial. If the Teasdale had worked, and both the security guys went to the elevator on one... It would buy them 5 or 10 minutes. If not, he knew he was close. In the end, safe-cracking came down to mathematics. You turned the dial at a certain rate. You had to hit the number after a certain amount of time. Marlin had a sinking feeling. Maybe he was just never going to get this safe open. He should have been at Olive Garden opening presents. It used to be that every birthday, his mom and dad would tell the story about the day he was born. They'd go back and forth, interrupting each other in their enthusiasm for the story, all about how it had been a beautiful fall day, the crisp air, the leaves turning, all this junk, and how her water broke in the middle of a job, and how she and dad had to go racing to the hospital with all the loot in the trunk of the car. He was doing 90 right through the middle of town when a cop had pulled them over for speeding. But then, when Marlin's dad had told the cop that his wife was having a baby, the cop put on his siren and led them right to the hospital. If the guy had only known they had $110,000 worth of stolen antique silver in the trunk,
They'd gotten to the hospital at 9:03 on the dot, Marlin's hairy little head popping out right there in the lobby of the hospital. Well, apparently the story wasn't interesting to Mom and Dad anymore. They had totally, totally forgotten. Not only was there no story, there was no card, no Olive Garden, no present at the breakfast table. Nada. Bupkis. It sucked.
15 seconds, Irving said. I'm clearing out of here.
I'm almost there. I can feel it.
Hey, kid, you can afford to get popped. You'll just go to juvie. Me? This is my third strike.
Marlin looked at his watch. 5 more minutes and I'm legal, he said.
Huh?
Irving's eyebrows went up.
Hold on. You saying today's your...
Yeah, today's my... Bing! He glanced up. It was the sound of the elevator reaching their floor. Damn it! His college tuition. It was right there. A normal life was right there on the other side of that safe, not 6 inches from his fingers. He was so close. He was sure he'd have it in seconds. He hesitated. His heart was banging away in his chest and his limbs were trembling. His finger twitched. And that tiny tremor was enough. The little gauge on the scope flickered. The last tumbler had dropped. Marlin grinned. Got it, he said triumphantly. As he grabbed the handle to pull open the safe, he could hear the sound of the elevator doors opening. Frantically, he yanked at the handle. The door must have weighed 300 pounds. It moved slowly, slowly on its oiled hinges. The elevators were about 50 yards from the executive offices. There was still a distant chance they could get away. Light, Marlin hissed. Irving hesitated, then flicked on his flashlight, directing it at the safe. Marlin kept pulling on the handle, the door yawning slowly open. The footsteps were growing closer and closer and closer. He could almost taste it now. Inside the safe was a stack of very specialized computer chips, each one of them worth $24,000 on the black market. His cut of the take would pay for 4 years of Princeton. He wouldn't have to crack another safe, cut another fence, nitro another lock, nothing. And then he could have a normal life. Be an accountant or a salesman or a middle manager at a life insurance company. He could be anything. The door swung all the way open. The footsteps halted. Keys jingled. He glanced over, saw the shadow underneath the door. He looked back at the safe. And a wave of sadness and horror swept through him. Except for a manila folder that lay at the bottom like some neglected piece of trash, it was utterly and completely empty. All this for nothing. Outside, the key slid into the lock. Marlin shook his head. It was all over. He glanced at his watch. He was 17 now. He had been eligible to serve hard time in the big house for 1 minute and 38 seconds. He wanted to cry. Irving's light flicked off as the door began to open. Marlin couldn't even move. He knelt there, staring into the black, empty safe. All his hopes and dreams, gone. Normal life, gone. Princeton, gone. Surprise! The lights flicked on. Marlin whipped around. Suddenly, people were coming from everywhere, crowding out of the closets and the cabinets and the executive bathroom. Happy birthday! Marlin fell to his knees. His father, grinning like a Cheshire cat, was walking into the room, followed by his mother, who carried a cake with 17 candles on it. Ray Ray was walking out of the bathroom. His friends Jerry and Justin and several members of his father's crew, they were appearing from everywhere. Marlin put his hands over his face.
God, you guys, he said. You scared the crap out of me. I can't believe it. I thought you forgot my birthday.
Marlin's father laughed loudly and gave him a hug.
Come on, his mother said. You think we'd forget this day?
I don't know, Marlin said.
I can remember the day you were born like it was yesterday, she said.
We were on a job, his father said.
It was a crisp fall day.
And the leaves were turning. Marlin gratefully let them tell the same old story. The cop who pulled them over, the antique silver in the trunk, the siren, the lobby of the hospital. A wave of relief and comfort swept through him.
So this was all a setup, huh? Marlin said. I opened that safe and it was stone empty. I about had a heart attack.
Empty? His father said. Marlin squinted at him.
Yeah, nothing there.
His father walked over to the safe, reached in, pulled out the folder lying in the bottom.
No, son, it's not empty.
Marlin looked curiously at his father's face. He was smiling broadly.
Son, I've been saving for years. His smile faded a little. You know, for a while it made me sad to see that your heart wasn't in this business. You have such talent. And it hurt me a little to think that you were going to squander it all. You could have been one of the great ones.
He sighed.
But you know what? You don't go into crime for the money. You do it because you love it. It's a calling.
Marlin's father spread his hands.
Son, I just want you to be happy.
He handed Marlin the manila folder he'd just taken out of the safe. Marlin looked at it blankly.
Open it, son.
Marlin opened the folder. Inside was a slim document. It said, Princeton University, Office of Financial Aid, Prepayment Plan.
4 years, kid, Marlin's father said. Paid in full.
Marlin's jaw dropped.
You mean this?
He made a gesture with his hands, taking in the whole office, the Mosler 37B, the folder, the circle of friends and family.
All a setup. Last night when I said I was going down to watch the ponies, I broke in here and planted this document.
He clapped Marlin on the shoulder.
This is it, kid. You're done. Last job. You're a citizen now.
His father looked at his watch, clapped his hands sharply.
All right, guys, we've had our fun. It's 9:15. The security guards will be back in 7 minutes. We gotta get out of here.
Marlin was beaming.
I can't believe it. This was so perfect. The safe, the locks, the security guards in the hallway. I bought the whole thing.
His father looked at him quizzically.
Security guards? What security guards?
That wasn't you? In the hallway? Pretending to be security guards?
Everyone in the room went silent. The footsteps in the hallway and the sirens in the parking lot outside went off at the exact same moment that the burglar alarm began to blare. Within seconds, the room was full of police officers, screaming and pointing guns.
Everybody down on the ground! Down on the ground, now!
It was over in seconds. Marlin lay on his stomach, a wave of darkness washing over him as the policeman put a knee in his back and cuffed him.
What's your name, kid?
Marlin said nothing. The cop pulled out his wallet, looked at his driver's license.
Hey, look at this, the cop said. Scumbag here just turned 17.
Marlin lay motionless. The Princeton University financial aid document lay on the floor near his face. A second cop walked by, laughing. His black boot trampling on the financial aid document, ripping the pages apart, and leaving a black shoe print on the torn paper.
Happy birthday, kid, the cop said, hoisting him to his feet. Happy birthday.
Tagger, by James Rawlins. Read by Rachel Butera.
With a practiced flip of her wrist, Su Ling Choi shook the spray can and applied the final trail of red paint against the cement wall of the dark alley. Finished, she took a step back to examine her handiwork, careful not to get any paint on her black silk dress. She wasn't entirely happy with the result. She'd done better. It was the Chinese symbol known as Fu, her signature mark. Only 16, she continued to be highly critical of herself. She knew she was talented. She'd even been accepted for early enrollment at the LA Academy of Design. But this was more important than any scholarship. She checked her watch. Auntie Lou would already be at the theater. She scowled at the mark. It'll have to do. Reaching out, she touched the center of the Chinese glyph. As usual, she felt the familiar tingling that made her joints burn. The warmth spread up her arm and enveloped her in a dizzying wash. The glyph glowed for a breath, pushing back the dark shadows of the alley. Done. Before she could break contact with the symbol, an icy cold pain tore at her wrist like talons. It seared deep down to the bone. With a gasp, she ripped her arm away and stumbled back. Ow! What the heck was that? She examined her wrist. It was unmarked, but an echo of that cold touch remained. She rubbed her arm, trying to melt the ice away, and studied her work with narrowed eyes. On the wall, her bright crimson mark had gone black, darker than the shadows of the alley. She continued to massage her wrist, bending it one way, then the other, struggling to figure out what had happened. The symbolic glyph, her tag for the past 3 years, was exactly like the hundreds she had plastered throughout the greater Los Angeles area. Did I do something wrong? Did I draw it too fast, too sloppily, make some dreadful mistake? Worry grew to an ache in her chest. She considered redrawing it, but she had no more time. The curtain for the ballet would be rising in less than 5 minutes. Auntie Lou would already be in the family's private box. With little patience for frivolity, her aunt would be furious if Su Ling was late again. As the pain subsided in her arm, the shadows seemed to drain out of the paint. The crimson richness of the Fu symbol returned, as if nothing had happened. Whatever the problem had been, it seemed to be gone now. She shoved the spray can into her messenger bag and hurried down the alley toward the waiting limousine. She shot one last glance over her shoulder as she reached for the door handle. The symbolic character still shone on the wall like a splash of blood. To most Chinese, it was merely a blessing of good fortune associated with celebrations of the new year. It represented two hands placing a jar of rice wine on an altar as an offering. But for Su Ling, the painted character of Fu was power, a ward of protection wherever she painted it. There would be no robbery at this location tonight. The proprietor of this 7-Eleven would be safe. Or so she allowed herself to imagine. It was a small way she honored her dead mother and her ancient superstitions, a way to stay connected to her, to a past that both mother and daughter shared that went back centuries, to villages nestled amid rice paddies, to mornings fragrant with cherry blossoms. She cast up a silent prayer to her mother and climbed into the back of the limo. A gust of sea breeze from nearby Huntington Beach wafted inside, tinged with just a hint of salt and an underlying trace of rot. A shiver shook through her. Just fish and algae, she assured herself. Behind the wheel, Charles nodded to her. They didn't need words. He had been with her family for as long as she could remember.
Wanting a moment of privacy, she raised the glass partition between them and tried to compose herself. Her reflection hovered in the window before her. Her long black hair had been coiled into a precarious pile atop her head, the cascade held at bay by a pair of emerald-capped hairpins. Her eyes matched the pins in color and shine. Like a ghost of mother. Over the past few years, Su Ling could not help but notice that she was slowly growing into her mother's image, one generation becoming another. An ache of loneliness and loss hollowed her out. She went back to that final bedside visit with her mother before the malignant lymphoma stole her away. The hospital room had smelled of bleach and rubbing alcohol, no place for her fragile mother, who believed in herbal tea remedies, the healing power of statues and symbols, and ancient superstitions. "This is passed to you, Si Lo Chai, my child," her mother had whispered, sliding a sheet of hospital stationery toward her. "It is our family's heritage, passed from mothers to daughters for 13 generations. You are of the 13th generation, and this is the 13th year of your birth. This number has power." "Mother, rest, please. The chemotherapy is very taxing. You need your sleep." Su Ling had taken the sheet of paper from her mother and turned it over. In a beautiful cursive script, her mother had drawn the Chinese character for good fortune. Fu. "My little Rose, you are now the guardian of the City of Angels," she said with a mix of pride and sorrow, struggling to breathe each word. "I wish I could have explained earlier. These mysteries can only be revealed after the first blood of womanhood. Mother, please, rest." Her mother continued, her eyes glazed by both memory and drugs. She told stories of prophetic dreams and the power to block curses with the proper stroke of paint on a wall or door. Su Ling had obediently listened, but she also noted the bleat of the heart monitor, the drip of the IV line, the whisper of a television down the hall. What place did all these ancient stories full of ghosts and gods have in the modern world of electrocardiograms, needle biopsies, and insurance forms? Finally, a nurse whisked into the room on rubber-soled shoes. "Visiting hours are over, Miss Choi." Her mother began to protest, but a quick kiss from Su Ling calmed her. "I'll be back tomorrow, after school." Glad for the excuse, Su Ling fled the room, relieved to escape not just the stories, but the demon named cancer. Still, her mother had called after her. "You must beware the..." But the closing door cut off those last words, silencing her forever. That night, her mother had slipped into a coma and died. Su Ling remembered staring down at the hospital stationery clutched in her hands. Blessing and luck, she thought. A lot of good it did her mother.
"We've arrived, Miss Choi,"
Charles said, drawing her out of the past as he pulled the limo to the curb in front of the theater in Santa Monica. Su Ling shook herself out of her reverie and slid across the seat. The driver already had the door open. "Thank you, Charles." As she climbed out, an anxious teenager in a rented tuxedo tripped down the steps toward her.
"Sue, about time you got here."
A smile filled her at the sight of him, but she did not let it reach her face. It was not proper for a Chinese girl to show strong emotions. Like casting her symbol, it was another way to honor her mother, to adhere to tradition in this small way. The young man rushed up to her. He stood a head taller than her, gangly in the over-large tuxedo. His long hair had been pulled back into a ponytail. Bobby Tomlinson was her age. He'd been her friend since kindergarten, one of her few. Both misfits growing up, they had banded together. He was a computer geek and film buff, and she was the shy student who never spoke above a whisper. Over time, they had grown to share a secret love of tagging. He had introduced her to it when she was 11, and she was instantly hooked. It became an outlet for rebellion against the world as her mother became sick, a sliver of freedom and joy that helped Su Ling cope with her overwhelming grief and anger. Over the next years, they ran the streets together, dodging police, struggling to leave their mark on the city in multicolored splashes of paint. The smile trapped inside her grew larger with the memory. Bobby led her up the steps and inside. He babbled on in a rush about his new intern position at Titan Pictures.
We start shooting tomorrow on the vampire musical I was telling you about. I'll be helping with the gaffing crew.
She glanced over to him and lifted a questioning eyebrow. He shrugged.
I know. I don't know what gaffers do either, but that's where I'll be working.
They reached her family's private box as the orchestra was winding through its first movement. Bobby glanced back to her, his blue eyes sparkling with amusement. The private box was empty.
Where's Auntie Lou?
She asked, expecting to find her aunt already here.
She called and said she had a merger to oversee at the bank. It's just us tonight.
Su Ling was shocked to find herself alone with Bobby. Not that the two hadn't spent many long nights running the streets with each other, but this felt somehow different. Both of them all dressed up and sharing this dark, private space. She was grateful the lights were dimmed. It hid the warmth that bloomed in her cheeks. Still, she hesitated outside the box seats, sensing something out of place. This was Auntie Lou's passion. Neither she nor Bobby were fans of the ballet. Plus, a small part of her wanted to escape, to keep moving, troubled by an inexplicable sense of being trapped. She rubbed her wrist and turned to Bobby.
You know, with Auntie Lou missing in action, we don't have to stay here. Over at the Grauman's, there's a movie retrospective of...
George Pal, he finished. I know, War of the World, those Sinbad movies.
She knew how much he loved special effects filmmaking, from the old-fashioned miniature models and stop-motion photography of yesteryear to the newest computer-generated gadgetry. In many ways, he was just as trapped between the past and the present as she was, stuck between the traditional and the modern.
Then let's go, she said, catching his enthusiasm.
Laughing, they fled the ballet and escaped in the limo over to Hollywood Boulevard. They were the only patrons of the Grauman's Chinese Theater that night, decked out in a tuxedo and a formal silk gown. As they passed under the massive marquee, Bobby took her arm under his as if they were waltzing down the red carpet of a movie premiere. Still, as much fun as it was, Su Ling was all too conscious of the old theater's ancient Chinese symbolism and architecture. It stirred again the ghost of her mother. But once they were seated, Bobby's enthusiasm sparked through her and pushed back any painful memories. He went on and on about why the director George Pal was the true father of the modern special effect, how stop-motion photography was a lost art. Then the house lights dimmed and the first movie started. A comfortable silence fell between them as they basked in the flickering glow that separated this world from the land of illusion. At some point, her hand ended up in Bobby's. She could not say who took whose hand. It happened as naturally as the brush of a stroke of paint. Still, neither dared look at each other, their gazes fixed toward the screen. As the lights finally rose during the retrospective's intermission, she turned to Bobby, ready to fill the silence with empty words. She wasn't ready yet to discuss where their relationship would go from here. Her hand slipped from his. Bobby... Pain erupted in her chest, a whirling blast of ice and fire that burned away any words. Gasping, she fell toward the floor. The theater faded to black as she slipped into pure shadow. As darkness drowned her, laughter accompanied her on the journey. The black amusement coalesced into a voice hoary with frost.
Next time, my dear, next time you are mine.
An image briefly flashed in her mind of the proprietor of the 7-Eleven. He lay face up in a widening spiral of blood, a raw-edged wound gaping in his chest. Then nothing. Darkness again. Reality snapped back into focus. Bobby's face filled her vision. She watched his lips move, but it took a moment for his words to make sense. Hurt.
Su Ling, are you all right?
She struggled to sit up.
Yes, I think so.
Should I call a doctor? It looked like you fainted.
No, Bobby, I just need to go home.
The air in the theater seemed thinner.
Colder. I'll go with you.
She didn't have the energy to argue. Leaning on his shoulder, she allowed herself to be half carried out of the theater and down to the limousine.
We need to get her home, Bobby told Charles.
Please,
she whispered. Collapsing into the leathered interior.
Can we pass by that 7-Eleven on the way?
She had to know for sure. Bobby climbed in next to her and shared a worried glance with Charles. Soon they were speeding down the highway, the traffic mercifully thin. She stared out the window, her breathing shallow. She clenched the edge of her seat with white knuckles. As they exited onto Santa Monica Boulevard, the traffic snarled because of a mass of sirens and flashing lights. They were gathered in front of the 7-Eleven store. A traffic cop, illuminated by a flaming red flare, waved them forward. The limousine glided past the store as a paramedic pushed a draped gurney into a waiting ambulance.
"Do you wish to stop, miss?"
"No."
She'd seen what she needed to see.
"You tagged this store, didn't you?"
Bobby asked, touching her hand, sensing her distress. She nodded.
"But you couldn't finish your tag, like back in Laguna."
She remembered. It was early in her new role as protector of the city. She hadn't really fully believed it herself. She'd allowed the police to chase them off before she'd completed her mark. Afterward, a fire burned down that store. Even after that, she hadn't been truly convinced. Still wasn't. She had taken up the food tag in memory of her mother, to honor her. A duty to tradition born out of guilt and loss. But now this.
"No," she answered softly. "I finished it. It's something else."
She remembered the icy claw and the black laughter. Words came tumbling out. She felt stupid even saying them, but she knew they were true.
"I think something knows about me and is hunting me."
Bobby remained silent. She knew he couldn't fully comprehend and probably didn't really believe in her powers, even though he had been the one to get her started. Bobby knew how deeply her mother's death had wounded her. One night, she had shared her mother's stories with him, her claims of a mystical maternal bloodline. Intrigued, Bobby had suggested using the symbol as her new tag, to add weight and purpose to their nightly runs together. And so it began. But down deep, deeper than she cared to acknowledge, Su Ling had always known it was more than that. She could not explain it. Tragedies drew her, called to her, and with a can of spray paint, she could somehow prevent them. Until now.
"What are you going to do?"
Bobby finally asked.
"I don't know."
"Should I call Auntie Lou?"
Su Ling frowned. Her mother's youngest sister, Auntie Lou, had taken Su Ling in after her mother had died. Her aunt was a loan officer for Bank of America, practical and serious. She poo-pooed the ancient traditions her mother held so dear.
"I'm not sure Auntie Lou can help with this."
"Or would even want to, for that matter."
But she might know something, anything to make sense of all this. With no choice, Su Ling fished out her iPhone. Her fingers trembled, making it hard to call up her aunt's number from the phone's contact list. Bobby reached and covered her hand with his own. He squeezed once, then slipped the phone from her fingers.
"Let me."
"Thanks."
She folded her hands in her lap to stop them from shaking. She stared out the window as Bobby called her aunt. His voice dissolved into the background hum of traffic. She spent the drive home struggling to understand. Someone knew of her work. Or something. Her sight suddenly glazed over, narrowing down into darkness. She blindly clawed for Bobby's hand. She clung to him as if she were drowning, but this time she knew what was happening. A vision opened inside her. She saw it all. Sun rising over the ocean. A shoreline bucking and tearing. Cliffside homes crashing into the sea. Screams filled her ears. Then a blank masonry wall appears, under the highway exit sign for Riverside, above a hidden fault line. She knew what that meant. The blank wall was her next canvas. It called for her work, called for her protection against this coming tragedy. As the vision began to fade, she felt both relieved and terrified. Even after 3 years, these callings spooked her down to the marrow of her bones. She could no longer dismiss them as coincidences or nightmares born out of anxiety and guilt. As the screams of the dying faded, mocking laughter followed. She recognized that trail of dark amusement. It was the hunter revealing himself, letting his presence be known. It was both a challenge and a warning to her. Bobby took her in his arms and held her to him.
What's wrong, Sue?
She hid her face in her hands, not wanting Bobby to see her so distraught and scared. In a corner of her mind, she still heard the jeering laughter over the screams. An earthquake. Tomorrow. She finally mumbled into his tuxedo jacket. I can block it, but he'll try to stop me.
Who?
I don't know, but we need to hurry. I need answers.
Only old stories.
Auntie Lou paced the red Moroccan rug of the living room. Cigarette smoke traced her path. She was a stocky woman who cut her black hair into a fierce bob, nothing like the slender grace of Su Ling's mother.
Mumbo-jumbo nonsense. All incense and pseudo-religion.
Auntie, I don't have time for this. You've been keeping secrets all my life. Su Ling sat straighter on the leather couch next to Bobby. Mother knew I had the power, and she must have told you.
Su Ling, you don't truly believe.
Something is coming for me, she said, cutting her off. I know it. A cloud of fear passed over her aunt's features. It will tear this city apart to get me, Su Ling pressed. Auntie Lu turned away to study the intricacies of a dynasty vase. Her voice became a faint whisper.
If you're right, then he's found you.
Su Ling's heart skipped a beat. Who? Her aunt refused to turn around, as if afraid to face any of this. It didn't fit into her world of spreadsheets and financial appraisals. Please, Auntie, who? Tell me.
Giu Su,
her aunt finally whispered, seeming to sag under the weight of ancient history.
The demon.
A stirring deep within Su Ling responded to the quiet syllables, Giu Su. With the beast named, her body knew it. What do you know, Auntie?
Just stories, told to scare children to bed, nothing but myths.
Su Ling crossed the room to her aunt and hugged her from behind. Auntie Lu trembled in her embrace. Not myths, Auntie. They're as real as my flesh. Her aunt broke their embrace and crossed to the fireplace.
I did not want to believe.
But why?
The family stories tell of dishonor, cowardice, and shame. Our family is a disgraced line. I was supposed to tell you when you came of age, but it seemed like fiction. I thought I could protect you from needless shame by concealing our family secret.
But I don't understand. Having this power, this ability to protect, should be an honor. Auntie tapped out her cigarette on a crystal ashtray.
It was. Once. Our clan was one of 35 chosen families, one from each province of China. Each family had the responsibility to protect its province. Our family guarded the Shandong province on the coast of the Yellow Sea. We were a cherished clan in China.
So what happened?
Bobby asked.
As the story is told, the gods of order and chaos are always at war. Guardian families grew to be a part of this balance. They were gifted with the ability to interrupt certain strands of chaos and deflect disasters.
Like I can do, Su Ling said. Auntie nodded and sat on the arm of a leather chair.
Yes, but over the passing centuries, the Chaos Lord became enraged at our interferences and forged a hunter from a part of his spleen, the Giu Su, to destroy the Guardian families. This hunter was unleashed, and many were destroyed before the families finally banded together. Each family sent one representative to form a union powerful enough to entrap the hunter. It took 35 guardians to encircle the beast and trap him, but before the enchantment was complete, one member, the one representing our family, panicked and fled. With the circle broken, the spell unraveled. The hunter destroyed the remaining 34 guardians. Our disgraced family was banished from China. After decades of wandering, we finally settled here.
But what of the beast?
The story told is that the Giu Su was injured by the failed assault and can only regain his full strength to push back into our world by finishing the destruction of the Circle of Guardians. He knows the power of the Guardian is passed to only one member of each generation.
Auntie Lou stared hard at her.
There is only one member left of that direct descendant line.
Su Ling crossed back to the sofa and plopped down.
And of course, that would be me.
Auntie Lou nodded. Bobby took her hand, a silent promise that she was not alone.
So how am I supposed to stop such a creature? It took 35 experienced guardians to stop him in the past. I'm only one. Where am I going to find so many others before the sun rises?
I don't know. The stories give no other clue.
Su Ling closed her eyes. If she did nothing, then L.A. was doomed. But how could she face this demon alone? From the hallway, an ancient grandfather clock, an heirloom of 3 generations, chimed once. They were running out of night. Bobby spoke up.
I have an idea, but it's a long shot.
Su Ling turned to him doubtfully.
How?
Magic.
At 2 in the morning, the studio lot still bustled. Spotlights and sodium lamps held back the night. Levi's-clad wranglers from a new Western mingled with black-robed ninjas from an action film, while prop men and camera crews scurried to and fro. No one paid attention to Su Ling and Bobby as they hurried across the lot.
What if we're caught?
She asked, sticking close to his side. Bobby pointed to his back. He'd replaced his tuxedo coat with a bomber jacket. The logo for Titan Pictures was stenciled on the back.
Got it with my internship. No one will give us a second glance.
She must have looked little convinced.
No worries, he assured her. This is the land of illusion. It's not about who you are, but who you appear to be.
He flipped up the collar of his jacket. Su Ling glanced around as they left the chaos and headed into a quieter section of the studio. Bobby had never fully explained his plan.
Where are we going?
Her friend kept walking.
Bobby!
He stopped and faced her.
If that demon is tracking you, maybe we'd better keep this on a need-to-know basis. For now, the less you know, the better.
For the first time, she read the fear in his face. He suddenly looked both older and younger at the same time. His eyes shone in the darkness, full of worry, but beneath that, something more. Something that had always been there, only she failed to recognize it. Until now.
You don't have to do this, he said. It's not too late. We could call both our families. Get the hell out of Dodge.
His words held their usual bounce, but she knew it was feigned, as much illusion as the rest of this place. He truly wanted her to flee, to run away, to live. She acknowledged his fear and what lay beneath it. Both gave her the strength to lean forward and tip up on her toes. When had Bobby grown so tall? She gently kissed his cheek, then lowered to her heels.
I'm not going anywhere, she said firmly. This is our city.
He smiled, blushing high in his cheeks.
Damn right it is.
Turning smartly on a heel, he led her away. And once again, her hand somehow found its way into his. Together, they hurried through the maze of backlots and alleyways until he halted in front of a green door marked FX.
Special effects? She asked, confused. I don't understand.
Bobby finally relented.
Seems like we've reached that need-to-know moment.
As he explained his plan, her eyes grew huge.
Are you insane?
She gasped and swatted him in the shoulder. He rubbed his arm while shrugging.
If you have a better plan.
She didn't. And they certainly didn't have time to